This evening, I'm going to indulge myself and you in sharing some very deep and personal emotions that have existed in me for many years and surfaced very sharply during my recent visit to Israel. And then I'm going to examine the source of those emotions, because they're emotions that have troubled me as to their appropriateness. And then, having examined their appropriateness, we'll try and learn some lessons from them. One of the things I've become accustomed to, for various reasons, is being out of sync. Thinking things that other people aren't thinking, feeling things that other people aren't feeling, looking at the world in ways that other people don't see, and continuously having to check myself as to whether I'm still sane and everybody else is crazy, or everybody else is sane and I'm crazy, or we're all sane, we just see things in a different way. And I constantly have to question how much of that different way of seeing the world and feeling the world is it right for me to share with you? Why expose you to an odd way of looking at the world? Why not just let you go with the flow? Do what everybody else is doing. Think what everybody else is thinking and feel what everybody else is feeling. That's the easy way to go. And sometimes I do challenge you and present ideas to you that are very different. And sometimes I question whether that's fair to you. And sometimes some of you question whether it's fair to you. But you keep coming, so maybe it is. The particular feelings that have been out of sync that I'm talking about started when I was a young boy at the beginning of my yeshiva career in 1967, immediately after the Six-Day War. And those of you who were part of the emotions of that Six-Day War will remember that the transformation of the State of Israel from a small, poor, struggling, spirited little territory to a major military force in the Middle East, to a nation that had recovered its pride, lost more than 2,000 years ago, a nation who had recovered territory lost more than 2,000 years ago, there was an exuberance, there was an energy, there was a celebration. And very quickly, the Israeli government began to implement plans to rejuvenate the old city of Jerusalem. Some of you who were there in those days will remember what the old city of Jerusalem used to be like. The old city of Jerusalem used to be like the Arab section of the old city of Jerusalem still is. But the Jewish section was no different. It wasn't a Jewish section, it was all an Arab section. And the area in front of the Kotel was opened up, the area in front of the Western Wall. I remember when we used to go to Israel as children. Some of you might remember that too. There was no place in the whole of Israel, no building, no tower, no anything, from which you could see the Western Wall. There were little places we used to go up, very close to the border, some of them right on the border. Old buildings, and we used to stand on the buildings and look down at the old city nostalgically, believing we would never be able to go there. But we couldn't see the Western Wall. The Western Wall was a very small piece of wall that had been preserved with a little passageway in front of it at which Jews used to come and stand and pray and cry. You couldn't see it from anywhere. But we knew it existed. But very soon after the Six-Day War, the Israeli government demolished all the houses in front of the Western Wall. They expanded the area. They opened it up into a massive paved square into which tens of thousands of people could come and do come on Yom Tov and other times, and it became a bustling, celebrated, energetic, vibrant center of Israeli life, not just religious life. Tourists from all over the world would come, and Israeli secular and religious would come. It was a central meeting place. And the city was developed, and archaeological sites were opened, and new buildings were put up, and yeshivas established themselves in the old city, and new buildings in old architectural character. And the little alleyways were restored, and the buildings were restored, and it started taking on a beauty and a romance once again. And this became so emphasized that there was a strong movement not to do away with Tisha B'Av, the day of mourning of the destruction of the temple, but certainly to do away with some of the prayers of Tisha B'Av, even to alter the wording of the Nachem prayer that we say in the Shmona Esra on Tisha B'Av, because that talks about the disgrace of Jerusalem and the loss of Jerusalem and the destruction of Jerusalem. And the viewpoint of that school of thought was, that's no longer true. We have our pride back. We have our joy back. There is no disgrace anymore. And I remember standing there at that time at the Western Wall and traveling through the country and walking through the alleys of the old city. And I just couldn't get it. I just couldn't see what there was to celebrate. Is that what God wanted the Western Wall to be? Tourists kicking cameras? People standing around it improperly dressed, speaking improperly, behaving improperly in front of the Temple Mount? Is that what we call a city without shame? Did it perhaps not have less shame when there wasn't that exposure? And I just couldn't be part of that celebration. I felt a pride. I felt a pride that we had done what we had done. I felt a joy that we had access to those places. But to say and to have any kind of sense that Tisha B'Av was any less potent now than it was before, I couldn't relate to that viewpoint. And then about 10 years later, we were in the midst of the Baal Tshuva movement, the return to religion, where tens of thousands of young people started becoming religious. And again, those of you who weren't in the religious picture prior to 1970 might not realize how out of fashion and unacceptable religion was up until that time. You just didn't do it. If you were a religious kid at school, you were victimized. If you were a religious academic at university, you were victimized. If you were a religious scientist, you couldn't get a job. If you were a religious businessman, you had difficulties and problems all over the world. It wasn't fashionable to be religious. All of a sudden, it became fashionable. Thousands and thousands of young people started taking an interest in religion, not only the Jewish religion, all religion. Religion, after having been so neglected for so many decades, became the in thing in the early 1970s. And there was energy and there was exuberance. The return to Torah and the return to Judaism. And look what's happening. And the new yeshivas that are built. When I was in yeshiva, you virtually knew every boy in yeshiva. Didn't matter what yeshiva, how many yeshivas were there. There were a handful of yeshivas. And each yeshiva, there were 200 or 300 boys. That was about it. Study for a few years, you got to know them all. Today, you don't even know the boys in your own yeshiva. The big yeshivas, when I was in yeshiva, had 200 or 300 boys. The really big ones had 400. Today the big ones have 3,000 and 4,000. And there are hundreds and hundreds of yeshivas. Big ones, medium-sized ones, very small ones. Hundreds and hundreds of them. Some on the right wing, some centrist, some a little bit more to the left. Some more Zionistic, some less Zionistic. Different shades and colors. But there are thousands, tens of thousands of young people studying full-time in serious yeshivas today. And that's wonderful, that's unbelievable. And wherever you go, you see religious people, and they're studying, and they're learning, and they take their Gemara with them. There are tens of thousands of people who learn the Daf Yomi. They learn a page of Talmud every day. I haven't a clue how they do it. It takes me 6 weeks to learn a page of Talmud. But there are tens of thousands of people who learn a page every day. And they're all on the same page, and they can speak to each other about it all over the world. And this has led to exuberance and to energy and to excitement. Look what's happening. And I don't get it. I just don't get it. I see loss. I see decay. I see deterioration. I see more and more people pursuing less and less. That doesn't excite me. The quality of the learning, the relevance of the learning. What did you say, Mr. Stripe? TRS. TSR. Torah, substance, and relevance. Don't see it. You don't see it. You don't see the substance. You don't see the relevance. You see translation. You see reading. You see technical mastery. You see memory. You see cataloging. You see organizing of information. But do you see a learning that alters an individual's paradigms in a way that changes his life and makes him a greater human being? No. Not that you don't see it at all, but you have to search. That's very, very rare. Do you see individuals working on their midas as they used to in yeshiva? Midas, character, human character. When I was in yeshiva, we used to have a session once a week, a very serious session was with Rebbe Lopkin himself at that time, working on character. That's all it was. It was just focused on character, not on knowledge, not on information. Just on what kind of a person you are, what degree of control and mastery do you have over yourself. At that stage, I was too young to really take advantage of it. But that was a focus of the yeshiva. When I was in yeshiva, some of the things that they used to make a fuss about. There were never enough coat hangers. There were always more coats than there were hooks. I don't know why every yeshiva has the same problem. Always more coats than there are hooks, by about 5 or 6 times too many. One of the things that the teachers were always very, very meticulous about was they would come down very hard on a young man who would walk in and put his coat over the next coat, the one that's there already. You came in later. Why should the person who came in earlier have to struggle to find his coat? Lift his coat off and put yours underneath and put his back on top. And there were countless things like that that were emphasized, that were important. And you finished washing your hand for the meal. Fill the cup up for the next person that he doesn't have to worry about doing that. Little things that were emphasized. Don't wake people up. Be very careful. Disturb a person's sleep, you might be responsible for the way he functions the next day. Be very careful about him. When you're living in a dormitory with young boys all over the place, where do you find a dormitory in the world where one of the values of the dormitory is treasure other people's sleep? Be very careful not to disturb people's sleep. So what does that mean? Where do you have recreation? Where do you speak to your friends? It doesn't matter. Find a place, but not near where other people are sleeping. These were things that were emphasized. These were terribly important. If there was food was dished out at the table and one boy wasn't present, before anybody helped themselves to the pieces of chicken or whatever it was, the choicest one was put away for the one who wasn't there. That was just the culture. That's the way it was done. You notice somebody wasn't there, the best piece was put away for him, and then everybody else shared the rest. There was that kind of awareness. There was that kind of consciousness all the time. We don't see a lot of that today. We see very little of that today. The Bein Odom L'Chaveroi, the extent to which people see their Judaism as impacting on the quality of their interpersonal relationships. Don't see that much anymore. Don't see religious people going out of their way to be examples in interpersonal conduct, to be examples in the way they treat one another, and the way they treat other people, and the way they treat non-religious people or non-Jewish people. These were all things that were emphasized. These are things that are no longer emphasized. So I don't get excited. I see the numbers, and that's wonderful to see. I see the numbers of yeshivas, and I see the people all over roaming around and learning with their gemaras under their arms, and that's great to see. But does that make me exuberant? No. And so I feel out of sync. I walk around with a long face saying things are getting so bad, and everybody else is saying things have never been better. And I've got to say, am I insane or are they insane? Or are we both sane, but we're just seeing it from a different perspective? Six-Day War was one time I felt it. The emergence of the Baal Tshuva movement was a second time. And I felt it again, not that I haven't felt it in between, I felt it all the time, but it surfaced vehemently again during this recent visit to Israel, where again the level of technical mastery of the learning is extremely high. The hasmoda, the application, the number of people learning and learning seriously is very impressive. The keeping of the mitzvahs, important, it's talked about, it's kept, there's an urgency about it, there's a seriousness about it. The Daf Yomi, as I mentioned, people learning a page a day, covering ground. Yet I look at it and I say it just doesn't look real, it doesn't feel authentic. Something's missing. Am I insane? Is there something I see that others don't? Am I having illusions? Or are they? But it just doesn't feel authentic. And then I meet a colleague of mine, one of the great minds in Torah today. For the sake of his own protection, I won't mention his name, although he probably doesn't mind. We were in yeshiva together. He was a little older than me. And he said, would you have thought when we were in yeshiva that they could destroy the Torah in 30 years? And then I thought, phew. So there are two of us at least. I'm not the only one. There are two of us. What is it all about? Am I out of sync? So start looking through the Gemara to see, is there any indication in the Gemara as to whether I'm out of sync or not? And I find the following. Gemara in Chagiga Daf Hei. The Gemara quotes a verse from Yirmiyahu, V'im lo tishmu'uha b'meistarim tivke nafshi mipnei gavo. And even though it might not be heard, in secret places my soul weeps, says God, because of the exaltedness. What does it mean? Omar Rav Shmuel Bar Inya Mashme Derav, Mokom Yeshlo LaKadosh Baruch Hu Umeistorim Shemoy. Hashem has a special place called Meistorim. Meistorim means a secret place. And that's where he cries, that's where he weeps. My mipnei gavo, what does it mean because of the exaltedness he weeps? Two views. Omer Rav Shmuel bar Yitzchak mipnei gei uson shel Yisrael shenitlo mehem benitna lo evdei kechovim. Because of the glory of the Jewish people that has been removed from them and given to the non-Jewish world. There again, when you visit Israel and you're able to picture through the archaeological sites, through some of the reconstructions that have been done, through some of the models that have been built, to picture the architectural majesty of Jerusalem, to picture through some of the historical reconstruction, some of the political majesty, the academic majesty, the intellectual majesty, the spiritual majesty, what Jerusalem was, what Israel was, what the Jewish people were. There wasn't an educated nation in the world. There was no nation that had that level of education, of knowledge, of literacy, of culture. It didn't exist. We towered above the world. And now, we take pride in some of our achievements, but we can hardly say we tower above the world in any area. In what do we tower above the world today? Religion? The Vatican. Politics? Washington. Military? The United States. Intellectually? Europe. What are we good at? And what do we tower? And what is there any area that you take the Jewish people and say, they tower above the world? And we used to tower above the world in everything. That was Jerusalem. That's what it meant. That's why the Romans hated it. Because it represented such power, such supremacy, such majesty. And it's not just that we lost it. The non-Jewish world gained it. They have it today. You walk through some of the great universities of the world, some of the old universities, walk through the halls of Oxford and Cambridge in England, and you realize what the yeshivas of Sura and Pumbedita used to look like. Realize what some of the yeshivas of Yerushalayim and Tzfat used to look like. Old established schools that have been in the same place for hundreds of years, learning, studying, teaching. We don't have that anymore. Wherever we've been after a few hundred years, we get thrown out and we move. We don't have those old, ancient buildings that have got steeped in tradition that you find in some of the older universities. The Goyim have got that. The non-Jewish world has received it. And God cries for that. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni Alman Bipnei Geuso Shel Malchus Shamayim. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni says it's not because of the glory of the Jewish people that has been lost. It's because of God's glory that has been lost. Which is interesting and parallel. That together with the removal of majesty from the Jewish people to the non-Jewish world, God lost His glory too. The Gemara goes on to question and says, "Mi iko bechiyo kame Hakadosh Baruch Hu? Does God cry?" V'homer Rav Papa, does Rav Papa not teach us that ein atzivus lifnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu? Hashem is never depressed. Shneimar, as it says, "Hoyd v'hodol l'fanov oz bechet v'obim kama." Wherever God is, there's pomp and glory. There's strength and power and energy and joy. Lord Kashia answered the Gemara, no question, no difficulty. Ho bevate gavoi, ho bevate baroi. There's a difference between the inner chambers and the public chambers. In the inner chambers, God cries. In the public chambers, He doesn't. Not because He's scared to be seen crying. He doesn't cry in the public chambers because in the public chambers nothing's wrong. The public chambers is where everybody's exuberant. The public chambers is where everybody's saying it's never been so good. What's there to cry about? Look how many yeshivas, look how many people studying. We've got the Kotel back, we've got the old city back. Israel is thriving, get rid of Tisha B'Av. On the external surface, you look at the world and everything's just fine. There's nothing to cry about. And God doesn't cry there. God cries on the inside because the inside is gone. The inside is lost. And when I saw this Gemara, I became comforted. I'm not insane. I look at things from the inside out. Most people look at things from the outside in. And if you look at things from the outside in, you don't notice that the inside is empty. If you look at your tooth in a mirror, you don't know that there's decay inside. You need an x-ray machine to look at it from the inside out, to penetrate the veneer and say, it looks very nice on the outside, but there's nothing inside. It's decayed. It's gone. God cries on the inside because the loss and the decay is on the inside. It's not on the outside. The outside has never been better. And the inside is dead. God cries and mourns that death and that loss. So is it only God and me? Are we the only two that figured this out? If nobody else does? So I became perturbed again. And I saw, no, other people do too. There's an amazing, powerful verse or two in the book of Ezra, at the end of the third chapter. Talking about the reconstruction of the second temple. Second temple is just rebuilt. First temple was destroyed. There was terrible suffering. And then the second temple is built again in the days of Ezra. And there's celebration and there's joy and the people thank God and they play trumpets to God. And the Rabbi Me'akwanim V'Halavim. But amidst all that joy, Ezra just throws in, there were many of the Kohanim, of the priests and the Levim, the Roshei Ha'ovos, and some of the heads of the fathers, Hazakenim, the elders, the leaders. Asher ro'u es habayis horishon beyostoi zeh habayis be'enehem, who had seen the first temple and seen the second one rebuilt, bochim bekol godol. They wept with a loud heart, with a loud cry.
The rabbim bitrua besimcha lorim kol, and many were celebrating and shouting in joy.
And the people could not discern the sound of the weeping from the sound of the laughter and the celebration. Because there were great sounds of celebration and there were great sounds of weeping, and they intermingled and you couldn't tell the difference. What is Ezra telling us?
The young people looked at the rebuilding of the temple and they said, isn't this wonderful? In our time, when we were born, there was no temple. Now there's a temple. We've rebuilt the temple. This is the greatest thing that could possibly be.
And the older people looked at it and said, call this a temple? You guys don't even know what a temple is if you think this is a temple. What was the difference? What did the first temple have that the second temple didn't have? Now this is really intriguing. And I'll share with you what it is that the second temple didn't have. The Gemara says in Yuma, the Chafalef, there were five things. Elu chamisha dvorim shayu bein mikdash rishon lemikdash sheni. These are the five things that differentiated the first temple from the second. Ve'eluhein, these are they.
Oroi, the ark in which the tablets of stone were kept. They were there in the first temple. There was no ark in the second temple. Kaporis, the beautifully crafted covering of the ark. Ukeruvim, and the angels mounted on top of that covering. Esh, the fire that would come down from heaven. Ushchino, and God's presence. Veruach HaKodesh, the Spirit of God, the Spirit of sanctity. Veurim V'tumim, and the breastplate of the high priest that one could ask questions to, and God would answer the questions through the stones of the Urim V'tumim.
Now I ask you, how much of this was visible to the public? The ark was in the Kodesh. You couldn't see it from outside. You couldn't tell whether there was an ark or not. Nobody went in there.
Where the ark was kept, nobody went.
So the ark and the covering of the ark and the angels on top of the ark, you couldn't tell.
And the fire that came down from heaven, only the Kohanim would know about that. And the presence of the Shekhinah, God's presence, how would you know if God was present or not? So what was it they were crying about when they looked at this temple that architecturally looked the same as the other and was as grand and as beautiful? And once again, there was a temple with temple service. Why were they crying? Was it the lack of the ark? They couldn't see that the ark wasn't there.
It was the lack of soul. They could sense the Shekhinah wasn't there. God wasn't there. Everything else was there. But God wasn't there.
What's the point of a temple without the Shekhinah? What's the point of a temple without the Ruach HaKodesh? The structure was perfect. And the world celebrated the structure.
And the older people who knew what soul was recognized that this was a structure without a soul. And now I begin to make sense to myself. You see, one can value physical things even without losing them. But one cannot value soul, truly value soul, until one has lost it. And that's why death is always such a shock. Why should it be such a shock? Don't we know about it? Don't we? And sometimes we know it's coming. It's always a shock. Because when you see a body lying on a bed, on the ground, heavy, pale, cold, a body that minutes ago was vibrant, then you realize what a soul is in a way that you never realized before. We know what soul is and we talk of soul, but until you see what a body looks like without a soul and how quickly it deteriorates and degenerates and how it loses everything that made it what it was. When we think of a person, we think of their features and we think we know them. But when they're dead, the features are all there. And you look at these features and you say, he's gone. There's nothing of the person here. And then you realize everything was the soul. Not the soul was important. Everything was the soul. that you only realize that when the soul is lost. And so it was the older people who had experienced the first temple and seen what soul was that could look at the second temple and say, this has no soul. The people who only saw the second temple looked at it and said, isn't this beautiful? They'd never experienced soul in a temple. And then I realized my difficulty was not only that I, through my teachers, had had some sense of what the Torah world was like when it had soul in the pre-war period. And they used to say how soulless it was then compared to what it was earlier. And they would say, and so far back, but the soul that there was, we don't have time now to go in, but you've heard some of it. Some of you have heard my father talk about those days and that era. I was privileged enough to have studied my Torah from people who learnt their Torah in an environment where there was soul. So I heard about it. And when I studied in yeshiva, there was still a bit of it left over. Some of the soul had survived. And so I suppose when I look around, I see what's missing. I don't see what's there. Here, what's there is structure. What's there is magnificent structure. And lots of it. There's numbers, and there's quantity, and there's mass, and there's knowledge, and there's information. And there's mastery of that information. But there's no soul. It's not about making better people, greater people, finer people. It's not about what I am and who I am. It's about how much I am. And in the secular world, it's about how much money or how much power. And in the religious world, it's about how much religion or how many pages of Gemara. But it's a how much focus, not a what. And not a who is the focus. You'll very seldom hear a Torah teacher say, I don't care whether you know Torah or you don't. What kind of human being are you? I would rather you didn't know anything and you were a mensch. You'll very seldom hear a teacher saying that today. You used to hear that. It's not important to know the Torah if you're an animal. It has no value. Teaching an ape to learn is irrelevant. So transform yourself from ape to human and then start learning. You'll never hear an educator say that because people will leave his yeshiva. They don't like to hear it, so they don't say it. And so we find people not transforming themselves. And you get the structure getting bigger, the layers get bigger, layer upon layer upon layer of veneer is laid over the people. But the work is not done inside, the filling is not cleaned up, the decay in the tooth is not repaired. It's merely another layer and another layer and another layer. And one can sense that. It's not only in religious life, of course. The Vilna Gaon said the period before the Mashiach comes will be a period of superficiality and artificiality, when the world will pursue appearance rather than substance, when the world will pursue quantity rather than quality, until the inside is so void and so vacuous that only through the coming of Mashiach will that be able to be filled. Let's have a look in the few minutes that remain at some of the sources and the origins of that, and of what happens when there isn't soul. See, the difference between having soul and not having soul is the source of one's energy. One can keep a dead body alive with technology. You can keep it functioning for a long time, but it has no real energy. Our energy comes from our souls. Yes, our bodies have to be in good shape to be able to manage that energy. If we're ill and we're incapacitated, that energy is limited, although there are people who have hardly had bodies at all but have had souls who've been able to be very energetic. People who've been paralyzed, people who've been completely bedridden, people who've paralyzed from the neck down but whose minds are sharp and there's an energy to them. The source of energy is not the body. The body expresses the energy. The body uses the energy. The source of the energy is the soul. And when one has no soul of one's own, one seeks the energy from sources outside of oneself. And that's where one gets the artificiality. One seeks the energy in comfort, and one seeks the energy in luxury, and one seeks the energy in variety, and one seeks the energy in experiences, and all sorts of things that have value. But to seek the energy in those things and those areas causes the energy and ourselves not to come from the same source. That is an authenticity when our energy comes from deep inside ourselves. And the same applies as a nation. When the Jewish people have a soul, their energy comes from within their own soul, and they express their Jewishness in everything they do. Jewish nobility, Jewish refinement, Jewish kindness, Jewish sensitivity in everything they do. But when the Jewish people have lost their soul, they seek their energy in the souls of others. And they adopt the spirituality and the soul of the foreign nations in which they live. And it doesn't sit comfortably. It isn't real. It isn't authentic. It's artificial. There are two interesting experiences that I want to share with you that illustrate this so clearly and are so pertinent to this time of the year. The one is this Western Wall that I made mention of before. We always knew there was a piece of Western Wall that had survived the destruction of the Romans. The Romans' destruction of the temple on Tisha B'Av so many thousands of years ago was vehement. It was so aggressive. It was so violent. And they destroyed every stone. They destroyed every brick. They destroyed every remnant, not only of the temple, but when they'd finished with the temple, they worked their way through Jerusalem and they razed it to the ground until nothing was left. Little piece of the Western Wall. But what always troubled us was the Medrash never said a piece of the Western Wall will survive. The Pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Hineze Omeid Achar Kosleinu. The Shekhinah, God's presence, stands behind our walls. And the Medrash says, which walls? Achar Kosel Ma'arovi Shel Beis HaMikdash, behind the western wall of the temple. Lama, why? Shenishva Lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu She'enu Chorev Lo'ilom. This is a Medrash from hundreds and hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago. God swore that the western wall would never be destroyed. Why not? Because the Medrash says, "Ein Ashkino Zozo Mikosel Amarovi," that God's presence doesn't remove itself from the Western Wall. And the Zohar says, because that's the point towards which everybody bows. If you are west of the Western Wall, you face east. If you are east of the Western Wall, you face west. That's the line that has everybody facing it. It's the only point that everybody in the world faces. Even if you're on the temple, you faced east. If you were outside the temple, on the western side, you would face west. If you were on the eastern side, if you're on the western side, you would face east. And if you're on the eastern side, you would face west. So everybody was bowing down towards the Western Wall, and that gave it a great deal of sanctity. And the bowing down, when one bows down and one prays, and the people who pray at the Western Wall, there's no arrogance in prayer. And you're praying, if it's real prayer with soul, and at the Western Wall people pour out their hearts, if there's humility, there's breaking down, there's no arrogance when you stand before God and you ask for things that you need. And so the Western Wall is the point that experiences the most humility. The other parts of the temple stood high and proud, but the Western Wall people bowed to. But more important than that, there's a legend that I heard but haven't found the source for. That whereas the rest of the temple was built out of donations given by the wealthy people, and things were named after people, this person's gate, and this person's corner, and this person's this, and this person's that, the Western Wall was created by the poor people who had no money to donate. And instead they used their labor to put one brick upon the other. And some of these bricks weighed hundreds of tons, by the way. There's one brick there that we saw that weighs 600 tons. Nobody knows how anybody got it there. But they did. They relayed brick upon brick, stone upon stone, through the sweat and the toil of the poor people who couldn't afford to make a donation that would have their name in neon lights. And that's the wall that has survived. That's the wall the Romans couldn't destroy. That's the wall nobody could destroy. Because that was created by soul. There was no structure in that creation. There was no glory in that creation. There was no ego in that creation. It was just soul. And the Romans couldn't destroy soul. We can destroy our own soul. They can't destroy soul. The Medrash says of Titus, "You ground up dust that was already ground, Titus. Don't think you were so clever. We ground it up for you. You could only destroy the temple because we destroyed its soul. Once its soul was gone, you could break it. But we destroyed its soul, not you." And we experienced that loss. And the other is a story that I shared with some of you already, and I'm repeating it not only for those who didn't hear it, I'm repeating it for those who did hear it, but most of all I'm repeating it for myself and for my son. Because I like remembering the story, because I never want to forget it and I never want him to forget it. And I'll tell you the story very briefly, where we decided to buy him a pair of tefillin for his bar mitzvah next year. And it was a long process how we chose where to buy this pair of tefillin, but eventually we chose a place who tried to dissuade us from buying tefillin there. He assured us that he was one of the more expensive places, if not the most expensive. He assured us there were cheaper places, and some of them quite reliable. He assured us he would introduce us to some of the cheaper places and help us negotiate a good price for a reliable pair so that we wouldn't have to pay as much as he was asking. Interesting kind of a businessman. We were the only customers in his shop, but he was there 50 years ago probably. I bought a pair of tefillin from him nearly 20 years ago. So his business has survived all the ups and downs of the economy. And eventually, after looking around and thinking and talking, we decided we were going to buy the tefillin from him. And eventually he agreed to sell them to us, quite reluctantly. Wasn't sure that he wanted a pair of tefillin going off to Los Angeles. Who knows what would happen to it. And he made some conditions with my son. So the sale is on condition. And one of the conditions was that before you wear the tefillin, enough time before that period comes, you know and understand every paragraph of the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah relating to the laws of tefillin. So you know every detail of the laws of tefillin before you use them. "I don't want my tefillin," he says, "being put on by a young boy who doesn't know how to handle them." So you've got to learn the laws before you use it. Like the DMV saying here, you've got to have a license before you drive a motor vehicle because people know cars are dangerous. Well, tefillin are dangerous too. You can misuse them. And that's very dangerous. Know how to use them. So the first law we learn together is the law of what happens if you have money only for a pair of talis, for a talis or a pair of tefillin, but you cannot afford both. Well, the law is you and a tefillin, just from an ordinary store. Now you've got some extra money. You can buy the best talus and an ordinary tefillin, or you can buy the best tefillin and an ordinary talus. Says the Mishnah Berurah, for the same reason you put the extra money into the tefillin, not the talus. And then the Mishnah Berurah adds on a few words and says that the communities are not particular about this law. Meaning, when they have some extra money, they find it much easier to decorate their talus than to improve their tefillin. Have you seen some of the silver decorations and some of the talisim? Sure, no problem. Somebody will go in and spend a few $100 on the silver decoration, no problem. You'll come to a pair of tefillin and you'll say, "How much is this one?" $150. And this one, $850. And what's the difference? They look the same. Well, then take the $150 one. You see, the difference in a pair of tefillin is on the inside. You can't tell the difference. Just as you couldn't tell the difference between the Western Wall and the Eastern Wall and the Southern Wall and the Northern Wall. They all looked the same. The difference was on the inside. One was indestructible and the other three were destructible. Because of the inside, not the structure. It wasn't about architecture and engineering. It wasn't about quantity and mass. It was about soul. You can't destroy soul. And if you pay an extra few $100 for a pair of tefillin, it goes on the inside of the inside. You might even look at the two parchments and they might look identical to you. The difference is in the quality of the person who wrote them and how long it took him and how much care he put into it. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference because you can't measure soul. It's an absolute, but you can't measure it. But to buy beautiful silver, a Torah for one's talus, and to have all sorts of colored stripes and chelis on the tzitzis, and all these beautiful innovations. Now you go into a shul, and no two people have got the same talus. One's outdoing the other in the exoticness of the talus. But the tefillin, the cheapest they can find. Because we still put our money and our energy in that which can be seen, rather than in that which is true, that which is real, that which is soul. And again, we can only value the soul when we've lost it sometimes. We only know what it really means when we've seen it and we've seen life without it. When we've seen a source of energy and that source of energy is taken away, and you realize any other source of energy is artificial, it's not the real thing. Then you can value and then you can understand. As the Gemara says, Kol haroye kol hamitzabel al Yerushalayim. Anybody who mourns for Yerushalayim, who understands what we've lost, not who goes to Yerushalayim and says, isn't this wonderful? Look what we've conquered. Look what we've achieved. But one can go to Yerushalayim and look at the architectural achievements and say, my goodness, look what we've lost. Where's the soul? If one can be Mis'abel al Yerushalayim, if one can go to Jerusalem and feel the mourning, Zoyche v'roye b'simchoso, then you will have the merit to see and experience its joy. Because very often, only through the mourning of a loss can one qualify oneself for the privilege of the joy of ownership and possession. And that's what Tisha B'Av is about. Tisha B'Av is the most important preparation for being able to experience the joy of soul. If we can only allow ourselves for fleeting moments on Tisha B'Av to understand what loss of soul is. Yes, one might have other soul and other sources of energy, but it's all artificial. If one can only appreciate what loss of one's own soul is, loss of that which is dear and close to one, that which is one with one, then we will be roye, zoche v'roye, we will have the merit and the capacity to see and to participate b'simchoso, in the joy and in the celebration of a renewed Jerusalem that recovers its soul, that recovers its spirit, that recovers God's presence. When we talk of Jerusalem, we're not talking only of Jerusalem. When we're talking of the destruction, we're not talking only of the destruction of the temple. We're talking about the Jewish nation. We're talking about Jewish community, we're talking about Jewish learning, we're talking about Jewish personality, we're talking about everything for which we stand, everything we're meant to represent. Those towering qualities we used to have because we were energized by our own soul, substituted by those dwarfing qualities we have today because we're drawing on everybody else's soul. If we can notice that and experience it on Tisha B'Av, we will begin to lay the first bricks of the foundation of the reconstruction of a nation that recovers its soul, seeks out its soul, works its soul, develops its soul, grows its soul, and draws its energy and its brilliance from within its own soul.